Hello, dear listener. Welcome to episode 50 of the Alexa podcast. This isn't the podcast. This is just a little bit I'm doing at the beginning to let you know that the episode was recorded before the announcement of the general election happening on July the 4th. It was also recorded before, you know, Jeremy Corbyn announced that he's running as an independent candidate in Islington North. So if you're wondering why me and Alexi aren't addressing the humongous elephant in the room, that's why, because we didn't know it was going to happen, because it hadn't happened yet. All right, that is to say, please listen to the very end, because at the end of the podcast, me and Alexi have a nice long chat about the world and some silliness as well. But the main chunk of the podcast is an interview with Paul Curry. I hope you like it. That interview was recorded in Alexi's living room. A little peek behind the curtain. When we record remotely, the sound quality is a lot easier to control. Whereas when we're in his living room and they're doing it in person, it can be a bit echoey sometimes. And I do everything I can with the audio. But, you know, this is a small independent production. We don't have that much equipment. We don't have a studio, that's for certain. That is why sometimes the sound quality sounds different in the interview chunk to the intro and outro. The intro and outro is normally done remotely, just me and Alexi, and that's a lot easier to control the sound. So all you people giving me grief in the comments about the sound quality, get off my back, please, you're hurting me. Right, let's get to the show. Thank you.
Hi everybody, welcome to episode 50. What a milestone that is. Episode 50 of the Alexi Sale podcast. Yeah, fireworks. Woo! Marching band.
50. So we're going for a champagne lunch today to celebrate.
Yeah, virtual champagne lunch. Yeah.
50, it's a lot.
It is a lot.
What, 3.5 years, a lot of podcasts would have put out a couple hundred by now.
Yeah. But we're not.
We don't
like
rush
that.
Things here, do we?
No.
We don't put things out for the sake of it.
No. So big news today. I have just come hot foot from the launch of Andrew Feinstein's campaign to stand against Keir Starmer in this ward in which I live, and I've lived for over 40 years. And we'll circle back to that, but I just, if you live in Holborn and St. Pancras, I would recommend Andrew Feinstein as your parliamentary candidate when the election rolls around. Mm. He is standing against the evil Ewok that is Keir Starmer.
Hairless Ewok, but the same.
No, I don't mean Ewok. What's the small creatures sort of in the monk's robes?
In the desert.
Yeah.
Yeah, they pick up the scrap and stuff. I don't remember what they're called, but they're meant to be little Arabs, aren't they?
Oh, really? Well,
there is a lot of connotation of like, they're like nomadic and desert.
Which ones are the Ewoks then?
Ewoks are the little fuzzy teddy bears Jedi. In Return
of
the
Jedi. They can be quite evil, can't they, the Ewoks?
Let's
not get
maybe
into
when
that,
the camera's not rolling, they eat their young and they fornicate with plant life and stuff. but no, the Ewoks are famously meant to be the good guys. I thought you were just commenting on his high-pitched voice.
All right, maybe I am. I don't know. I've lost track. I've completely lost track of where this is going. Anyway.
Andrew Feinstein.
Vote. We're going to be, I hope to be part of his campaign. And he is an exemplary.
He is. And we'll talk about that at the end of the podcast.
Right. But
because we got a big one today, haven't
we? Yeah, this is a big one, people. This is the one that's gonna break us out. We have the first interview that Paul Curry, I don't know. Do you want to explain what happened to Paul Curry?
Yeah, we'll get into it in the podcast. But in February, he was slandered mercilessly in the press. Thanks to the campaign against anti-Semitism, they spread some nasty lies about him, completely misrepresenting a situation in his gig. You may have seen him on the headlines of the BBC and Daily Mail and all that. You know, what were the headlines like? Vicious anti-Semite Nazi kicks Jew out of theater because of their, you know, because of their visible Jewishness or whatever. Yeah. You know, they were just saying horrible shit, and that's what all the headlines were saying.
Yeah,
unanimously, and none of them reached out to him and asked him what actually happened. And actually, all it was a comedian throwing a heckler out of his show. Yeah. That's all it was, and had no reason to know he was Jewish or think he was Jewish. And in fact, it wasn't just Jewish. He was an ex-IDF Israeli Zionist who was being racist in the audience. And for the safety of the show and the audience, and, you know, people were turning on the heckler. Paul Curry got him out of the show, I can't believe. But that, all that will, you might remember that from the news, and all that's going to be explained in detail by Paul Curry for the first time here on the Alexis Hill podcast. Isn't that wicked, Alexi?
It is wicked, and let's go ahead and do it right now.
Everybody, and I think this is the first scoop. I think scoop would be a not too big a word for it. Sensational achievement for the Alexis Hill podcast. We have the first interview from Paul Curry, comedian, and well, we'll get into, you know, how he became center of on the front pages for a few days eventually, but hi, Paul. Welcome.
Hi, Alexi. It's an honour to be here.
Well, good. It's good to have you. So, I guess, start with telling us about you were, you know, how you became a comic and, you know, anything you want. And...
I played in punk bands in Belfast in the 90s. That was my first foray.
Did you go to college? Or
I did. I went to art college, yeah.
Another art school.
Yeah, I went to art school in Belfast for many years. And
what's that like as a college, Belfast?
It's good. It's flattened now, the one I was at.
Really?
It's gone. And it was quite an iconic building as well. It was called the Connor Hall, named after Connor. I've forgotten his first name, but he was a famous Belfast artist who painted a lot of street life in Belfast. And a lot of iconic punk bands played in the Connor Hall back in the day as well, too. No Means No, Sonic Youth. Stuff like that, sort of real underground punk bands, but it's gone. They rebuilt it. But it was a great. It was disgusting. It was a real shabby. That's why they knocked it down.
I know it's
It's not. It's all very fancy modern architecture.
So. Yeah.
I studied visual communication, the more commercial end of.
That's what we used to call graphics.
Graphic art. Yeah.
I don't know.
But I ended up kind of twisting it to more sort of installation art that I did. So I did some installation video pieces.
So they were, I don't know how the system, I mean, how does the art school system working on that? Is it the same as here or is it?
I think it's pretty much the same, yeah. I didn't want to do a master's or anything. I just did a degree. I got a degree.
Did you foundation as well?
Yeah.
At Belfast?
Yeah.
So you were there for, 4 years?
I did the foundation in a different part of Belfast in a separate building and then transferred to the bigger art college and then graduated from there in 1998.
Okay.
So, yeah. So I pretty much spent all of the 90s in further and higher education because before that, I was doing performing arts.
Okay.
So I dropped out of performing arts in the early 90s and then went to art college, realized I didn't want to be an actor. I was at the Edinburgh Fringe for the first time in 91. With a Yeats play.
Right. Yeats play.
Yeah, it was very short. Yeah, very short ones. We did the Hawkswell and the Cat in the Moon. Very short little.
I only know the poetry. I didn't know
he was. Yeah, he did a couple of short plays, which we did.
Yeah.
So that was my, But it was in punk bands before the performing arts.
Right.
So that's, most of the 90s was in artistic further education with college stuff.
Was that, well, we were talking, I don't know, we were talking before we started recording, yeah, really about trauma and the troubles and, you know,
yeah.
I first, I think, performed in, I must have performed in Belfast, I think, in probably 82, 83.
Right, okay.
And, you know, there was, I think they were a Highland regiment. I remember seeing this, you know, a patrol through the streets of, you know, central, kind of berets with pom-poms on. Yeah. And I remember they had the big old, they had the British L1A1 assault rifle, which was the 7.62mm.
Did you get excited about that?
Well,
yeah. Ooh, I haven't seen one in real life.
Well, that was the standard British Army battle rifle at the time. So we were, I recently did one of my episodes of Strangers on a Train in Northern Ireland, Belfast.
Yeah.
And I kind of avoided, in a way, talking to the people about the troubles. I mean, it inevitably came up, but I thought I didn't necessarily want to, I don't know, I was interested in talking about more ordinary things.
Yeah.
But I mean, it is clearly for you, it was a central part of your experience. And you were saying before we started recording that it informs the performer that you became later. So maybe you could talk about
Whenever I ventured into doing stand-up comedy, I mean, I'd been brought up on The Young Ones, Monty Python, and then ergo I traced the origins of Python back to the Goons and Milligan. So I was a big fan of them and listened to a lot of recordings of them. So I came from a very surrealist point of view with my stand-up.
Right.
I specifically went down that more Andy Kaufman, you know, testing the audience kind of thing, you know.
Right.
And also I consciously wanted to break people's concepts of what a stand-up comedian from Northern Ireland talks about.
Right.
I wanted to break that just by being weird. So people would then go, after the gig, would go, where the hell is he from? Belfast?
Right.
And then completely break any preconceptions that they had about, because I would cover up my accent as well. I would do numerous types of accents. I would do from posh English, you know, Goons-esque, you know, I was going down the Sellers, Peter Sellers route of, of just throwing my accent everywhere so people couldn't pin it down.
Right.
So that when I walked out on the stage, they didn't immediately make a judgment on me, you know. So I made a conscious effort to do that, but in a clowning, kind of clown way, you know, physical comedy way.
Do you think that was also informed by your art school experiences and your exposure to, like, performance art and...
Yeah, I guess so. I mean, I was also heavily influenced by Steve Martin as well, too. And it was actually listening to his album and seeing him live that I realized that was that's what pushed me into doing stand-up. Because I was obsessed with Vic and Bob. I was obsessed with Python, but they were all teams and groups.
Mm-hmm.
So I didn't know how to do it as one person on a stage. Mm-hmm. So as soon as I saw Steve Martin doing it, he was a one-man cabaret variety act.
Right.
I was like, shit, you can do it.
You can
make balloon animals. You can pull shit out of a suitcase. You can do whatever the hell you want.
Yes. I mean, that's something that's inspired about Steve Martin, is it that remember him saying, which is not, you know, if you know how to do something as a comic, you will find yourself doing it, you know.
Yeah.
And he could roller skate and play the banjo, and he found himself roller skating while playing the banjo, you know. But I actually think that that's not necessarily the case. There is a type of comic that I don't particularly like who just stands there and talks.
Really. Yeah,
and that's not my idea of stand-up in a sense.
Me either, but I have so much respect for the people that can do that with just a microphone. The story as a prop, you know. I have a lot of respect for that, but it's not my... It's like I would walk into an art gallery. Watercolors are fine, but it doesn't do it for me.
Right.
So, you know, I much prefer the more surrealist stuff that really pushes your brain a bit more, you know.
So how did you... Well, how did you get started, I suppose? I mean, where did you perform and how
On
did
the street.
That...
In fact, still walking. was my first foray into doing solo performance to a crowd with stilt walking. So I teach in the Belfast Circus School.
Right.
I've been doing that since 2000. And I teach the wee ones. We teach a little group called the Itty Bitty Circus. We also teach adults, and but I specifically teach the wee ones, 2 to 7 year olds. And then I also do outreach workshops with adults and teenagers with special needs. So we do that as well too.
Yeah.
But my first performances were on stilts. We would do a 2-hour stilt walking gig, and you were just left on your own to go and walk around the event, whatever the event might be.
So it would be at a festival?
Festival, or even the street. The council would pay us to like go out and just entertain people at a certain time of night to bring a bit of colour, because the Belfast City Council had a lot of money back in the early noughties. So they were just like throwing it at us going, six stilt walkers walking up and down Royal Avenue. So you'd have
That's what we need.
And you learn, pretty quick as well when the when people arrive into town to go to the pubs, or when the pubs come out. Because if you're on a set of stilts,
you're a target for
a group of six drunken men or women, to be honest, because you're at the groping height.
Oh, right.
Crotch or bum. So you'd kind of hold on to a lamppost as they were walking past. So, yeah, that was my...
hard, still walking on the
Is it hard?
Is it difficult?
It takes a few weeks just to build up the confidence to... And then you learn how to... You fall. You have to learn how to fall properly.
Yeah.
On your knees. We wear knee pads.
Right.
So if you're going to fall, you fall onto your knees, not your wrists.
Break your wrist.
Yeah, break your wrist. A few friends have done that.
So that's how you started.
That's how I started in.
So Belfast City Council
decided
that the best way to counter the effects of 30, 40 years of civil war was...
Yeah.
People
Circus.
Why not?
Which was ironically, it was set up by an Australian.
Right.
Who came all the way back.
An Australian.
Yeah. Who was descended from Irish settlers in Australia. Came back to Belfast and set up a guy called Mike Maloney, who's sadly passed away. He set up the Belfast Circus Guild.
Right.
And do you know Martin Big Pig? He's a stand-up comedian.
No.
He does a bit of writing for Frankie Boyle. Anyway.
No.
He's a stand-up comedian. He was also one of the founders of the Belfast Circus.
Okay.
So I was basically doing 2-hour stilt walking gigs. I went to a comedy club one night in the Empire. I'm sure you know the Empire Comedy Club in Belfast, maybe.
I don't. You're thinking, you're mixing me up. Somebody who lives in the 21st century.
I basically went to a stand-up comedy club, saw somebody do a 5-minute spot, and went, what, 5 minutes? And I do like 2 to 3 hour still walking gigs. I was like, I could do that.
Right.
Surely I could do that. So that's whenever I started them. And then seeing Steve Martin, and then I just pushed myself onto the stage.
What was the stand-up scene in Belfast? So what year would this be?
That would have been 93.
What was the comedy scene like
93, 94. It was really small, really small. In fact, the night I went to that comedy club, it was a very young Tommy Tiernan.
Right.
He was performing at the
end. I know who he is.
I know him. I know that one. He was performing. He had a lot more hair by then.
Right.
And no beard. And I just remember seeing a couple of... He was the main headliner, and then a couple of people doing 5-minute spots. And I thought, oh, fucking hell, I could try this.
So what did you do? Did you do stilts on the stage? What did you do?
No, my concept was... This is how I got my head around the nerves. Was that stilts, the foot plates on stilts are like tiny stages.
Right.
So essentially a stage is like one big massive stilt.
Right.
When you're up above the audience, you know, because you are raised to a certain degree. There's a bit of a level change. So that's how I convinced myself I could do it. Because, I would go to comedy clubs and just be in awe of these one person on a stage captivating an entire audience who have paid to make me laugh.
Yeah.
Whereas when you're on stilts, it's a lot easier because you're on stilts and you've already got that awe factor that you want on stilts. Then the comedy comes after, whereas comedy club is like, they've paid, you better make me laugh.
Right.
So there's more pressure, obviously, on you then.
I'd never thought of it like, now you've got me worried.
So
So you progressed... open spots, and then you start getting paid in Belfast.
Yeah, but I mean, I didn't transition into weird comedy. I just went straight for it.
Really?
Okay, I just went for it big time. So I was bringing props on stage and doing weird bits inspired by Andy Kaufman and Steve Martin. And
I suppose Andy would tell us a bit about it. I mean, Andy Kaufman, for those I mean, came to fame over here as Lekka Gravis
in Taxi.
In Taxi, But he was, well, there was a Jim Carrey film called Man on the Moon, isn't it, which was about Andy Kaufman. But I mean, I guess tell us a bit about Andy Kaufman.
Well, I mean, I saw The Man on the Moon. I kind of had I'd heard a little bit about his alternative comedy that he'd done stand-up, but of course I'd only known him from Taxi. So that was, I just like researching stuff. So whenever I found out that he wasn't just this TV sitcom character.
And I mean, you could tell in a way that it was something different about him just from the energy that he brought to that.
Absolutely.
Sitcom was,
He could, he was barely in a lot of scenes, but he absolutely stole it. So I researched pre-YouTube. I ordered all these DVDs from a dealer, of rare video footage on the internet of every bit of footage I could find of Andy Kaufman performing.
I think it's better when you have to make a bit of an effort rather
than... Oh, absolutely, yeah.
Yeah.
It's not just straight on YouTube. Yeah. So I had to wait for these to come through in the post and DVDs. So I have a collection of all these DVDs of like really rare footage of Kaufman that some of it I don't think even has been uploaded on the YouTube. And I watched that and I just absorbed that as much as I could and then started to write my own kind of versions of that. Like there was a sketch where he just sat, press record on a tape recorder to Canned Laughter and ate a bowl of ice cream on stage. And I then transitioned to a piece that I do now, which I've done for years now, where I eat a bowl of cereal on stage and just have a breakdown to the theme tune of Arthur. So as that transitions into the saxophone break in the Arthur theme tune by Christopher Cross, I then start spitting the cornflakes over the whole audience until I'm dripping in milk and the front row's dripping in milk. Yeah. And it's become quite a famous bit that I do where people are...
Right. I saw you do that in Edinburgh in probably the hottest room I've ever been in. So we're all sweaty and sticky and now we're covered in this fucking spitty milk.
Yeah, milk and cornflakes and...
But I've seen Paul multiple times in Edinburgh, and his show is so good. His performance, his performing is, it's mostly without words. And
the Soho show, the one that was completely nonverbal.
Yeah,
that was the first time I ever thought I'm going to try and do a completely nonverbal show.
I just want to let the audience know that you're one of my favorites, and I would make sure every time I was in Edinburgh, I'd come and see you. Beautifully crafted, you give the sense of chaos and unpredictability, but you can tell that it's beautifully choreographed, really thoughtful and powerful sometimes, and then just gloriously silly. And everyone, you always pack the house at Edinburgh as well.
It's 13 years of going back every year, tenaciousness, you know, because I did the first year, two people. I did that. I've been through the whole, I learned very quickly to, because I don't have management. I've never had management or agents or anything like that. I did go to Edinburgh 1 year with Avalon.
What?
Glad you did that. And I did that once under the wing of the eagle of Avalon, and I thought, you know, because I read up on the Avalon rostra, I was like, oh my god, wow, all these, and learned very quickly, because I'm from a very punk background, very DIY punk background, and as soon as I read their contract that they gave me, and I gave it to a friend who was a lawyer in Belfast, and they were like, don't sign this, they said change this, and I gave it back to Avalon, and they just went, what? I'm sorry, who are you? And I was like, I'll sign it if you change these. And they were like, just like, nah.
So you didn't have
one. I just went, no. I told them I'm not going to sign this. So they took me up to Edinburgh with the idea that I would sign with them after Edinburgh.
Right.
I read the contract after Edinburgh.
Right.
And went, no. Yeah, that was an eye-opener for me.
Yeah.
That was an eye-opener for me.
What are your goals? And I mean, do you see it in that way in terms of a career, really, I guess?
I guess I did at one point.
Right.
I mean, I'm, nearly 20 years into doing it now. And Yeah, I had those dreams and aspirations for a while when I was starting out. But like I said, I started seeing behind the wizard's curtain quite quickly,
right?
And realized that it wasn't everything that I hoped it would be. I mean, yeah, I dream about being a taskmaster, but I know that's never going to happen, ever. And so many people have messaged me over the years going, why are you not on Taskmaster? You should be doing it. I'm like, yeah, it's not going to happen. I mean, it's owned by Avalon, isn't it?
Is it? Yeah.
It's never going to happen. But I'm just, look, genuinely happy just to be out there making people laugh. I mean, I'm a clown at heart.
So, I mean, can we jump to your, Soho? Yes, the Soho and the events of, when was it now?
The events. Of February 10th.
If I may.
I feel like we should be wearing wigs. Should be wearing wigs at this point.
Yeah.
So.
February 10th.
2024.
dun, 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 dun.
Bon.
So on the morning.
It was a morning, like any other.
Yeah, I heard tell that there was a Palestinian march happening in Camberwell, where I was staying. So I, of course, being the diligent humanitarian that I am, went on the march. 2.5 miles it was. Wasn't expecting it to be quite that long. but it was a really beautifully condensed little group of people that congregated on Camberwell Green. We went for a walk right up the whole way up to Tate Modern. So it was great. It was very passionate. And it was a very small group, but fair play, I have to say, fair play to the police. The police
would be fantastic.
Do you know what I mean? They were fucking brilliant. They kept us clear. There was a lot of abuse being shouted at because it was a small group.
Right.
Of about 40 to 50 people. It wasn't a huge throng, but we eventually got up to the Tate Modern at the back of the Tate Modern, and there was a much bigger gathering, and we did that and we listened to a lot of the speeches, and there was a lot of impassioned speech, you know, just about the murders of the children that were happening, especially particularly on that day. I think there'd be more reports coming in,
right?
So yeah, we did that. I had the gig that night. I uploaded a video onto my Instagram of us walking along and whatnot, and shouting ceasefire and whatnot. And then I went and did the gig that night. So I guess that was kind of, you know, in the back of my head, still sort of fresh in the back of my head. It was the last night we did. I was doing 3 shows. It was the final night. It was a full show, full sold out show. And the whole show, Stum, which is ironically Yiddish.
Stum, yeah.
That's the name of the show, Stum. Although we say it, and I mean, it's said, we use it a lot in Belfast and Scotland as well. Yeah. Keep Stum. So that was,
and this was downstairs in Soho.
In the cabaret room and downstairs. Yeah,
I know it well.
And the show went well. And I did the bit in the near the end of the show where I did it previously in Edinburgh the year before, where it was just the Ukrainian flag that I held up in this particular sketch that I do, and it was to the music of John Farnham, and the music cuts on a particular line where he says, we're not going to sit in silence.
Right.
Where I cut the music at that point, and I just edited it with the awkward drip of a tap.
Right.
And an echoing drip of a tap, just to emphasize the awkwardness and the magnitude of people not speaking out about conflicts. And that's what that whole bit was about. It was about conflicts. It wasn't specifically about Ukraine. It wasn't specifically about Palestine. But because I'd only used the Ukraine flag the year before, and then everything that happened on October the 7th and after that, I felt like I'd be cheating myself as a performer, as an artist, not to emphasize that. So I said to a friend before I was going to London, I was like, could I have a lend of your Palestinian flag? Because I'm going to use that and that. And it was, and it's quite a short bit. I have to hold up both flags and get on with the, it's and I mean, to be fair, I could have held up numerous amounts of flags of other conflicts and wars that are happening right now, but it's a very short sketch. So I just did Ukraine and Palestine and then threw them away and sit in silence with the whole audience, which gets a huge awkward laugh because everyone, just before that, if I'll put it into context, I'm having a bread fight with the audience before that.
Okay.
So I hand out loaves of bread to the theme tune of the Hovis song comes in, and I start handing out slices of bread, like the, you know, like in the Catholic Church.
Yeah.
And I'm kind of blessing people and whatever. And everybody, so then everybody rips up the bread. They've all got bits of bread. And then at a certain point in the Hovis song, it stops. And then this hardcore acid dance song comes on. And the I just hold up a sign that says bread fight on it. And everybody just gets in their bread fight. So it's a 140 adults all throwing bits of bread at each other. Silliness. But yeah. There is a more... there's a more serious bit to it, which is I write bread written in B-R-E-D, which is about humans just being bred right. to fight as tribes. Tribalism, how everybody instantly gets into a fight, into a war, into a conflict super quick. And that's what happens in the bread fight. Everyone's having great fun throwing.
Right.
So that happens. And then everyone's hyped up after having a bread fight. And John Farnham kicks in. And I'm getting everyone to kind of, yeah, you're the voice, trying to understand.
Right.
We're not going to sit in silence.
Right.
Drip, drip, drip. So everyone's like, oh, shit. And then I mime a TV and I mime a TV remote control and just sort of, you know, dormantly sitting watching the TV the way everyone is. And then I don't say anything. I just shrug my shoulders and go, you know.
Right.
You be the judge of what we're not doing or okay. doing. And that's what that whole bit is about. It's about conflict and how everyone's just kind of sitting around doing nothing really, you know, or not enough people are saying stuff. And it's in a nonverbal show, so it's perfect for what I'm trying to emphasize. Then I move on to the next sketch. Do you want me to explain all this? Yeah?
Yeah.
I move on to the next sketch, which is Rainbow Connection, sung by Jim Henson. Now, the connection with that for me is that I'm a Jim Henson Muppeteer.
Right.
I studied with the Henson Company, came over to Belfast. We did two seasons of what was called Sesame Tree, which was supposed to be the UK version of Sesame Street. Mm. It only lasted two seasons, but what Sesame Street have is around the world, the production company go to places of conflict where there needs to be conflict resolution.
Right.
Of course, the main place in the UK is Belfast.
Yeah, right.
So they did it in Belfast. We did two seasons. I was very lucky to get to perform with Carol Spinney before he passed away, who was Big Bird and Oscar the Grouch. So I got to meet him as well. So I put on Kermit the Frog in this penultimate sketch where he's singing Rainbow Connection. But in the middle of the sketch, I take Kermit off my hand and just drape him dead on a table behind me. And I continue performing with a naked hand
right.
to the whole song. And, the metaphor behind that for me is about the children that are being killed in conflicts who are never going to get to fulfill their childhood dreams, which my childhood dream was to be a Jim Henson Muppeteer.
Right.
I was obsessed with Sesame Street, obsessed with the Muppets, and I finally got to fulfill that. So these children are never going to get to do any of that, you know? And so that is an emotional piece. And a lot of people are crying in the show to that bit. You know, I do it very straight. It's not a comical bit. It is more of a poignant performance art piece, you know. And then I finish with that. Take a bow behind the table that Kermit's draped over, the dead Kermit. And I pull out a set of massive angel wings.
Right.
And this is a metaphor. And it's a sort of a homage to Terry Gilliam's Brazil.
Mm-hmm.
and the song Brazil kicks in, which is a really joyous song. I go to jump with the wings on, goes to blackout, and then I resort to a tiny little version of me, which is a little Action Man puppet with a pair of wings, and then I fly over the audience, the entire audience, because he's spotlit with a little torch at one end of the stick. So it's just goes to blackout. I'm flying over the audience, away from this dystopian nightmare, which is, of course, what Brazil is about and which we're all living through right now.
Indeed,
yeah. And that's it. Lights come up. I take a bow. The Palestinian-Ukrainian sketch is way behind us at this point. It's gone, and
You didn't fully explain that the pulling out the flags bit.
Oh, did I not?
No, you.
No, I thought you did.
We went off on a. You were talking about the.
Yeah, so the John Farnham song kicks in. I pull out the Ukraine flag.
Yeah,
hold it up.
You said that.
It was back then.
Pulled out the Palestinian flag, put it away, and then.
You did? Yeah, you said that.
Forgive me.
Oh, that's all right.
Shut up.
So the mini-me on the stick is now on the, along with all the other props, the whole stage is strewn in props, bread, milk, confetti, all sorts of things. I then do this fake bit where there's already a stool sitting on the stage. I sit down and start pretending to be an audience member giving me a standing ovation. And it usually works. 9 times out of 10, everybody starts, I'm sort of going, and everybody's sort of going, okay, we're going with this. And they give me a standing ovation. Not everybody does it.
Right.
Not everybody does it. And I'm not expecting everybody to do it because it's just a stupid fake, egotistical cry for, please give me a standing ovation.
Right.
Everybody stands up. Not everybody does. And I'm aware at this point that there's, I'm aware at this point, there's people to the right of me who haven't stood up. In fact, there was people stewing around because I can see they're quite obvious that people haven't stood up. So I get everyone to sit down. Show's basically over at this point. I take the microphone and I do what I do in every show, which is do the whole kind of, it's very Steve Martin-esque as well. Thank you, everybody, for the standing ovation, and thank you guys for not standing up, you know.
Right.
And that's it. That's what I said. The next bit, this is where it all goes pear-shaped.
Yeah.
People start booing in the front row.
Really?
And I'm not aware of what's happened, but people start booing, and I immediately assume that they're booing at me.
Right.
So I'm like, what the hell's just happened? So there's just this joy of a standing ovation. Everyone's, you know, the Kermit the Frog song still lingering in the air. Brazil's still. And I'm aware that something's happened over here with the people that hadn't stood up, or a group of them. And I'm trying to look at the eye, you know, where these people are looking, and I'm aware that it's two people sitting a couple of rows back, or a guy that's sitting a couple of rows back, and I stop these people booing because I'm, you know, I don't want to finish, it's my last night at Soho, I don't want to finish on a negative vibe in the room. So I stop them booing and I have to then go over to him. Now, he's heckled, and in the interviews,
people 2 rows back,
he's heckled, but this has come out, I only found this out, what it was exactly he said in interviews, like, but weeks after, he admitted to saying, thanks for holding up the Palestinian flag, as in, thank you for, you know, like.
Yeah.
So he retorted back to me on that. But I wasn't specifically talking to him. I was talking to everybody that didn't stand up. And so he heckles me. They start booing. I look over and try to find out exactly what he said. He says, I said to him, so you didn't enjoy the show? You genuinely didn't enjoy the show? And he went, no. And I was like, right, okay. People start hissing and booing him again. I go like, whoa, whoa, whoa. Because everyone at this point, obviously, I've just finished 1 hour. Everyone's on my side. But I don't want conflict in my show.
Right.
So I'm going, please, please, hang on a minute till I figure this out. And I looked at him and said, are you being sarcastic right now? Are you being serious? And he went, yeah, I hate that flag. And I was like, what are you? And I said to him, are you being sarcastic? Because I can't read him because he's got this big arrogant grin on his face, and I can't tell if he's just joshing with me, just sort of trying to wind me up. I'm also trying to figure out, from a stand-up comedian point of view, trying to deal with a heckler, trying to figure out, is he drunk?
Yeah.
Is he on something? Is he sober and serious? Yeah. Is he being racist? Is this genuine, like, hatred coming from him? Or is he just mucking around and trying to fuck with me and play with my head? So I say to him, are you being sarcastic? Directly at him. And he goes, big smile on his face, nods his head, yes, I am. Right. So I go, oh, cool, great. And I look at the audience and go, it's fine, we're all good. He's just winding me up, he's being sarcastic. I look back at him and go, right? Thumbs up, you're being sarcastic, right? And then he shakes his head, no. And I'm like, what the fuck is going on? In my head, I'm thinking I'm being gaslit here right in front of this audience. This guy's just mucking with me, right? And I'm like, hang on a minute. So you're being sarcastic. Or so you're not being sarcastic. And he says, no. Then at this point, in my clown head, my improv head kicks in. And I'm thinking, I need to deal with this because this is getting weird. He could be, you know, dangerous or hateful in some way. And I don't want this coming into the room. So I look at the audience with the microphone in hand and go, don't worry, this is a part of the show. It's all good. And I look back at him and go, right? Remember we rehearsed this? Yeah, this is part of the show. Yeah. But this wasn't where you were meant to. Yeah, you've kind of fucked it up a bit. And he goes, no, no, no. I hate that flag and I hate you for using it in your show. And I'm like, what, dude? And I'm kind of wanting them to just back down off this.
Right.
I don't want them to go there. And I say to him, look, mate, you do realize that bit, because I start getting a little bit serious about this, and I'm like, you realize that bit was about ceasefires, okay? And I'm from Belfast, and ceasefires are pretty important to us in Belfast. Extremely important. I lived through a ceasefire, yeah? And people in Belfast know more about ceasefires than any part of the UK, yeah? So you need to... He just smiles and shrugs it off and looks at me like I'm a piece of like, you know. It's at that point then, whenever he just sort of shows absolutely no respect at all whatsoever for what I've just, the effort I've just put in for the last hour, in a show that's about humanitarianism, about peace. I then lose it and just go, look, mate, read the room. Just go. Just fucking go, please. Just leave. And he sits back in his chair, folds his arms in a very cocky fashion, and he's still smiling. And I'm like, just get the fuck out. Get the fuck out. And people in the front row are just shouting, get the fuck out as well. Let's just leave. People are going, leave. Because they're just getting this hatred that he's just exerting this hatred, you know, this xenophobia, this basic racism, right, in front of me towards a singular flag. And I said to him, like, what, you know, before that, I'd asked him which flag was it, and he specifically said it was the Palestinian flag. So I was like, you need to go. You just need to go. Because I don't want this level of hatred in my room, and I don't want to finish the last show like this. So I tell him to get the fuck out and that I'm being serious. So he stands up, and then his friend next to him stands up, and they start putting their coat on really, really slowly, antagonistically slowly. And again, he's still smiling, smirking away. He's so cool and calm, which is freaking me out even more because I've never seen a heckler do this.
Yeah.
Sober. I've seen him doing it drunk.
Yeah.
But he was clearly sober, right? He then chooses to walk through the two rows in front of him onto the stage, which is fully lit because the house lights aren't up. He could have left in the dark.
Yeah.
He chose to walk right onto the stage, which weirded me out even more. I stood back because it's not a big stage. I stood back to let him pass, at which point he's smiling at me. And there's been witnesses, all the witnesses in the front row have corroborated this, that he was, and verified, sorry, that he was smiling and not in any way intimidated whatsoever. Smiling at me, smiling at some of the people in the front row. And it's at that point, his arrogance just like really got to me. And I just held up both flags and went, which one was it? Which one was it you didn't like? And held out the Palestinian flag and went, mate, it was about ceasefires. Yeah, ceasefires now. And then the whole audience kicked off shouting ceasefires now as he walked out. Again, smugly grinning. I mean, he walked across the stage like he was on a catwalk.
He didn't have to do that. Dude.
He did not have to do that. No, he didn't. I have to emphasize, in my brain, in my comedian's brain of doing comedy for over 25 years now, where you're trying to read the person who's bringing this hatred in, I assumed that he was some kind of posh London twat. Yeah. He was really well dressed, really handsome. He was a very handsome young man. And after going on the march that day and everybody's shouting abuse at us, I just, you know, you're aware that people just don't like the Palestinian flag. They just hate it because it interrupts their day.
Right.
Mm. And that's it. And that's all I was getting from him was like, oh God, not another, you know. Right. And I tried to explain to him calmly, you know, because I know the reports were like, I just lost it straight away and kicked him out. I was trying to calm the audience down against him, but he just kept digging a hole for himself. And it's that point I told him to get the fuck out. So he leaves the room, everybody shouting ceasefire now. At which point then I say, if anybody else doesn't agree with the ceasefire, you can fuck off as well. Four or five people in the front get up and walked out. They were an older crowd. They didn't even really seem to be enjoying the show that much anyway throughout the
day.
So they left, leaving about 140 odd people in the room. To which point, I'm still trying to play on the whole, this is a part of the show. This is an Andy Kaufman bit. Right. This is all a big setup. They leave the room, at which point I look at the staff who are standing over at the bar going, what the fuck? Most of the audience are going, what the fuck? Is this a real thing? And then I look at the staff and go, okay, they know they're supposed to come back in again, right? Yeah. Oh, no. And I'm sort of playing on the whole, oh, they fuck this. Like, you know, we've really messed up this bit. And then I just drop my whole shtick and just tell the audience, look, I basically say, look, the reason why I'm so angry is that what's happening right now over in Palestine, if the British government had taken the same stance against the IRA, if the British government had taken the same stance against the IRA in the 1970s, as Israel are against Hamas and the Palestinians right now, I wouldn't, like, you wouldn't be here.
Yeah.
Because I wouldn't be here, because I would have been a dead baby.
Yeah.
I would have been a dead baby under the rubble in 1974, which was at the height of the troubles when I was born. I just said, you know, I don't condone, I don't condone any form of terrorism or violence. But the IRA didn't speak for the people of Belfast, and Hamas do not speak for the people of Palestine. It's as simple as that. It's as simple as that. And the self-defense thing, you know, Belfast would have been flattened if the British have, you know.
Yeah.
So I made that point and just said, look, and I'm angry about, think about all those children as well too, who could have been comedians or performers or, you know, surgeons, doctors, whatever. They're all, it's gone. That's completely gone. And then I just left the stage. And,
right.
You know.
Thinking, and then what happened?
And then I went upstairs to the Soho Bar for 2 hours,
right,
chatting to most of the audience who came up and thanked me for doing what I did.
Right.
A lot of Jewish members of the audience came up and were saying, thank you so much for speaking out about that. People from the Middle East who were in the audience, people of color, people come up and said, wow, holy shit, 2 hours in the Soho Bar having drinks, being offered a lot of other gigs around London, ironically. And then the next day, I start getting emails from... really heavy right-wing Zionist hate mail.
Really?
Yeah, death threats to me and my family. And it just spiraled until... And I just stopped looking at my emails at that point.
Had your email or you... That was like...
See, this is what... I don't use Facebook anymore, but somebody made me aware on Monday. Because the next day, I pretty much had my phone switched off. Anyway... that my email was available on my Facebook page and my phone number. So I was getting texts and emails, you know, from all these, I literally 3,000 emails.
Precious.
Yeah. And I sat and had to delete all these emails on the Monday, on the boat, on the way home. So I was driving back from London to Liverpool to get the boat back to Belfast. And I was just getting these phone calls. Now, I was asked to phone Soho Theatre the next day. They messaged me to say, we need to talk about the incident. We've just been made aware of what happened on Saturday night. So I heard nothing on Sunday whatsoever. But the crazy thing is, I was emailed by Soho. I wasn't given a phone number to call them back on. So this was a big thing that we're still trying to figure out and looking into. They were asking me to phone them, but they were giving me no way of actually contacting them. And I had an email, that didn't seem to be having much effect. So by the Tuesday, I think that's whenever Soho released their statement.
I think so. Without talking to you?
No, without talking to me. And they basically, in their email, email they sent to me on the Tuesday night, which was about 7 p.m., they said, we're going to have to release a statement because you haven't contacted us.
Right.
To which I immediately emailed them and said, you haven't given me a number. And I checked back on all the emails. They never gave me any number. I was like, can we talk now before you release this statement? Because obviously I need to see it. To which point they sent me the statement. But then as they sent me the statement went live.
Oh, shit.
Yeah.
Hold on. Has the press already started talking about it at this point?
I've been messaged by numerous...
But had the headlines come out at that point? Was it before or after the statement?
I think there was press stuff because the guy that I threw out immediately was whisked off by someone to all the newspapers and he was doing like TV interviews and stuff like that as well too, which I didn't watch any of. People were messaging me going, are you okay? And I was going, why? And they were going, your name's all over the press. This guy's a...
So to make it clear for the listener, what the press was saying was a comedian throws Jew out of Soho Theatre. That was the line they were going with.
Yeah.
Every headline mentioned that he was a Jew and that's why he was being thrown out.
Yeah, that I targeted a Jewish person in my audience, which was insane because to even suggest that I knew that he was Jewish in itself, I think, is pretty anti-Semitic.
Yeah.
If you want to use that term in the right context.
He wasn't, as they say now, visibly Jewish.
Like, which is
the he was Israeli. Was he Israeli?
It turned out that he was Israeli and that he was in the IDF and that his Twitter account said that he was a proud Zionist.
Right.
And that he worked for Google. and that he bought the ticket 15 minutes before the show, and that according to him, he checked performances. He consciously checks a lot of performances that he goes to make sure that he's not going to be offended and that the person isn't pro-Palestinian.
Right.
Or, you know, anti-genocide. And somebody that works for Google, I just find it quite suspicious that he didn't check my Instagram.
Right.
Who's obviously clearly well up on his smartphone. Probably has the smartest of all smartphones.
Well, I'm sure he does.
And he could have checked my Instagram instantly.
Yeah.
To see that I've been on that march that day. But he plowed on into the show, like I said, non-verbal show, and chose to engage with me, heckle me at the end of a show at the only point where I have a microphone.
Right.
Because I have no mic for the whole show. It's completely silent.
I thankfully have really only been caught up in minor versions, very, very minor versions of what you have been through. I mean, one of the things about it is that, in my experience, that it stops you thinking straight, really. That you are, if you're a decent human being, you are beset with so many conflicting emotions, really, of annoyance with yourself, of shame, of anger, of rage.
Mm.
And it stops you, and I think certainly in a political sense, you know, when we talk a lot about the attacks on Corbyn, for instance, to jump to that was a kind of deliberate tactic, that they know that you can't, it's hard to make the right decisions, if there is a right decision about this situation. I don't mean, am I putting words in your mouth, or do you feel that, or how did you feel?
Afterwards?
Yeah.
It felt, and still does to a certain degree, although I'm a lot more educated in the entire situation of what's happening over there and the tactics that are being used. But at the time, it just felt surreal because, like I said, there was people...
Yeah.
Like the show, apart from that one incident at the end, the whole show went great.
Yeah.
You know, so people... And afterwards in Soho Bar, people coming up and thanking me and after... But then whenever I saw what was happening, the emails I received were just horrendous. I mean... It was just on.
That's good. I mean, at the very least, when you get emails, in my day, it used to be letters like that. I mean, just to be so, somebody feeling that level of vitriol, hatred towards you is in itself profoundly upsetting.
Yeah, it is. It is. And it makes you extremely paranoid as well. You know, I mean, I was even getting the boat home that night after I had to sit and go through. I tried not to read a lot of the emails, but I had to physically go through them. It was about nearly 3,000. And I just sat waiting to get on the boat, just going through all these emails, delete, 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 delete. And, you know, some of them I could read the start of the rant. And it was straight away.
Do you think these were, I mean, these have come just from reading the coverage, or do you think this was part of an organized?
Well, I have no idea.
Part of an organized
to be like, I mean, I'm so naive to all this that even people were saying, oh, this is a setup. This has to have been a setup. Yeah. And I'm like, what? Yeah. People don't do that. Humans. Yeah. Human. I am very much a naive, idiot clown at heart. And I would never dream.
You clown.
Yes. You crazy clown. That someone would plant themselves in an audience to do that. But a lot of people have been suggesting this, and the further it gets away from it, the further I'm away from what happened that night. I'm like, you know, the Columbo head starts kicking in.
Yeah.
Like, wait a minute.
Yeah.
This is very suspicious, a lot of it.
Well, this is...
I have no idea.
Where the CAA come in as well, because it was... How did they get involved?
So the quote-unquote Soho statement said that they were taking advice from the CAA.
Fuck's sake.
Actually said in their actual public quote, we are seeking advice from the CAA. Now, I had no idea who the CAA was.
Remind us, Alexia.
The CAA is an organization that was founded in 2014 after one of Israel's earlier incursions into Gaza, in which they killed several thousands civilians, mostly, again, women and children. And it was supposedly to correct kind of anti-Israel, anti, and therefore anti-Semitic bias in the British press. Now, the head of the campaign against anti-Semitism was a guy called Gideon Falter, who is also the co-chair, I think, of something called the Jewish National Fund, an organization that has been involved in ethnic cleansing of Palestine for more than a century. So you understand that his sympathies are not just a hate, as they present themselves as a as an organization which is rooting out hatred. It is not. It is a pro-Israel lobby group. It exists solely to shut down, to police, to attack anybody who expresses, either tells the truth about Israel or expresses pro-Palestinian views. That is the function of the campaign against anti-Semitism. And of course, they also came to the front in the smears against Jeremy Corbyn in association with the Jewish Labour Movement. The Jewish Labour Movement is allied with the Israeli Labour Party. The Israeli Labour Party is pro-settler, pro-genocide, pro-apartheid, pro-ethnic cleansing. Mm. That is the so-called campaign against anti-Semitism. Now, obviously, in the Western press, for whatever reasons, this group is treated like, say, an animal rights group that is only motivated by the feelings of animals, that they have no political agenda. They have a massive political agenda. That, ladies and gentlemen, is the campaign against anti-Semitism.
Thank you. And then recently, you know, a couple of months after your gig, Gideon Falter, co-founder of CAA, was caught up in a... He was caught trying to manipulate video to make it look like the police were being anti-Semitic to him, kicking him, not letting him cross the road and all that.
I think essentially, first of all, I mean, the campaign against anti-Semitism has always campaigned virulently against the pro-Palestine demonstrations, have called them hate marches and all, tried to promote all that, you know, London's not safe, you know, not a safe area for Jews at the weekend, all that bullshit. And I think Falter was initially trying to provoke an incident, really. And then when that failed, he kind of got involved with the police, really.
So these are the people who advised Soho.
And Soho took their advice.
That's fucking shit.
Which is absolutely sick. But, you know, And this is Soho Theatre. I've performed for them like at least four other times over the years. I've done shows. I couldn't believe that they'd throw me under the bus like that, basically, you know?
It is.
There's been and very few other comedians or performers have been speaking out about it as well. Ironically, whenever I got cut, then the CAA targeted me for every gig that I was doing.
Really?
Yeah, and I got taken off my Australian tour. I was going to do Fremantle, Melbourne, and Brisbane, and they all cancelled. Because of the emails that they were that the CAA were just blanket emailing everyone with all these hateful emails about me. Thankfully, a few places didn't, which was eye-opening. The whole thing's been very eye-opening. A lot of doors have been shut. Loads of doors have been opening.
Right.
People are really showing themselves.
I think there is a change.
Yeah. So Utrecht Comedy Festival, for a start, I messaged them to say, are you going to cancel me? Or am I getting cancelled?
You know. Utrecht,
and they said their email was amazing. I mean, it made me cry, to be honest, because everything was falling apart at this point. All my gigs were crumbling. And they said, we will always believe the artist over the media any day. You're not being cancelled. You're coming to do the gig. I couldn't believe that. It was a complete antithesis of what I was hearing from so many other places, you know?
I was talking to a fairly well-known comedian who's also friends with a very, very, very well-known comedian, and he said both of them will never perform at Soho ever again.
Wow.
Well, certainly I won't, but...
Yeah.
I don't like it anyway.
I mean...
I have to say, yesterday, as a kind of... Knowing that I was going to interview today, I like to go down to Soho Theatre and this... And there's my poster on the wall, and I like to sit underneath my poster. And also the manageress there, she says her uncle has told her never to let me pay for a coffee.
Oh, that's...
I can go there and get a free flat white, or sometimes if the staff recognise me, I get the staff discount. So I went down to the Soho Theatre yesterday, cafe, just to sit there underneath my poster. But interestingly enough, they've put...
stools in the window, and they've built a kind of a counter in the window that goes straight into my face. So, fuck you, Soho. So my poster, Chapico Sandy, is just above me. And then underneath, you can, the counter goes into my right into my face. And underneath, you can just see the tattered remnants of a poster saying Alexi Sale.
You need to make a little cardboard cut out of it and wear it.
Myself. So that's probably my last visit. That's my last free coffee in Soho. But I understand in a way that I think that there will be. I think comics will not perform. Perform there anymore. Yeah. Whether speaking out for you, I guess, is taking more of a kind of chance.
Yeah, I mean, it's not even at the end of the day, it's not about me. It's about the principle of the thing. You know.
Yes, I mean, really, it's despicable beyond belief for Soho not to at least, you know, even if you're not. They haven't got your phone, you know, just put out a statement without speaking to you, because they owe you a duty of care. You're their employee, aren't you?
Yeah. And they had watched the show on the Thursday.
Yeah.
The people that had booked me had come and watched the show.
Yeah.
So they'd kind of given it the thumbs up and said it was all good, which is weird that then they were so surprised about what happened at the end. But of course, then it was just blown out of proportion. He immediately said, and all these, because there was the four people that got up and walked out whenever I said, if nobody else agrees with it, they kind of backed this up as well. And then there was other third-hand evidence that was coming out. The problem was there was so many witnesses who were emailing on their Instagram, emailing Soho to say, that is not what happened. And they just chose to ignore a lot of that.
And they had staff in the room who I'm sure they asked straight away.
Staff in the room. In fact, and I'm not going to name names, mainly because I can't remember his name, but one of the, I'm not even going to say his rank, but one of the staff came up and said to me afterwards in the dressing room, thank you, my grandfather is Palestinian.
Oh, right.
Yeah. And thank you for doing that. Like, kind of whispered it at me. Like, he didn't want the rest of his colleagues to find out, because God knows what was going on with Soho. But he came up and made a point of saying, thank you for doing that, you know. And again, that was in my head. The fact that a staff member came up and said, thank you for doing that, because, you know, I've got Palestinian blood and I appreciate that.
Yeah.
So it was a bit of a shock when I started receiving all this hate mail and read what was recorded as supposedly happening.
And it was front page news, wasn't it?
In certain publications, yeah.
Yeah.
Every fucking headline, including Guardian, including BBC, would include the word Jew in the headline, kicked out, and implying that it was because he was Jewish. And only like the ones that you would expect to be left-leaning, it would be like three paragraphs in where they would vaguely explain the actual situation. Mm. Where, like, and not even as much detail, no one got in as much detail as what you've explained today to us, but like the fact that he was heckling and that the audience booed him and got them out, and maybe it wasn't because he was Jewish. But every headline.
Like, how the hell was I meant to know he was Jewish? Like, seriously. Yeah. I mean, seriously.
Yeah.
I mean, you could argue, like, because he was having a go at the Palestinian flag, but then what does that say? Does that say in itself? Yeah. I mean, that's just sick. Yeah. Yeah. And it's the fact that I had been on that march that day, and I had been on many marches before that, and just the hatred.
That was the other thing. The pictures they chose to put of you in these articles was a screen grab of your video from your Instagram of you on the march.
Oh, yeah.
You do videos, and you're marching, and you're talking to your camera going, we're here for Palestine, and you're saying something to the camera, And they've chosen to screen grab it when you're making an F noise, and it looks like you're going, fucking Israel. Like, they chose that one photo that makes you look like you're looking angry and hateful.
Yeah.
Whereas if you watch the video, you're actually saying something quite lovely.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's just the
it's the way the media the works, way though, isn't it?
They paste hate onto us.
Yeah.
And make us, they're just giving us hate where there isn't one. We're pro-Palestinian out of love for humanity, out of love for children, out of love for Palestine, out of love for justice. It's not, it's not that we're anti anything. We're pro-Palestine. It's a positive thing.
Yeah. It was the same as the human rights marches, just going back to Belfast as well, you know? I mean, my accent, whenever I was growing up, anybody's accent from the north, if you came over here, you're immediately a terrorist.
Yeah.
You were a frigging terrorist. You know, that was it. You were, you'd either planted a bomb or you had a bomb on you, or you were about to do something. The Irish flag was always associated with terrorism as well, the tricolour.
Yeah.
So, I mean, the parallels and then the blueprint. I mean, Belfast really is, should be, Belfast should be the fucking blueprint for what's happening over in Palestine right now. And
yes.
From day one, whenever what happened on day one, well, not day one, it's been happening for over 75 years.
Yeah.
But from October the 7th,
They always say, what else could we do? Well, you could not fucking kill everybody start, you know.
But
what else do you expect us to do? Well, you know, like, not murder 15,000 fucking children.
Exactly.
Be a good start.
And what happened in Belfast was they had to sit down and talk to these people. You had to sit and talk with the IRA, with Sinn Féin. They had to talk to people. And it just seems to be that it's the same. It's just happening again, but over there. Well, they don't want to talk to them. They're just, everyone's guilty. Everyone's a terrorist. Everyone's, you know.
Human animals.
You didn't feel, so you've remained silent, I think, until this podcast. I mean, you didn't feel, I mean, I wonder whether you didn't feel that you should get your narrative out there.
No, because, like, to be fair, the newspapers, and to see how they were twisting the story in favor of the heckler that I threw out, I just knew that it was going to be a hatchet job, and they were going to stitch me up. I just didn't want to go near that. I felt comfortable coming over to talk to you because I know your stance, but also, you know, I'm a big fan of your politics anyway, and I have been for a long time. And I wanted to meet you in the flesh. In the flesh. I felt this was a safe space, and I'm talking to Talal as well, and you know, you're approaching me and offering this to me. But I definitely feel like having kept quiet for this length of time, it's all coming out, how twisted it all is.
Yes, I think world is seeing.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Totally. It's like, I liken it to the metaphor in my head is it was an arranged marriage between the two, and there's been physical domestic abuse that's been going on for over 75 years, but the curtains are open and the neighbors can see what's happening now. Right. They can actually see the true story of who's beating up who, who's punching who.
Yeah.
You know,
I agree.
But where it's coming from.
Yeah.
People are seeing it now, though.
They are seeing it.
Because through TV, movies, the media, whatever, over the years, you know, the Palestinians have been painted as this.
Yeah.
You know? But it was this, I hate, you know, I'm drawing the parallels, but Belfast was the same. It was movies, if you were, you know, IRA, Belfast.
Patriot Games.
With their terrible accents.
Even the Irish actors have terrible Irish accents.
Well, that was the thing. They were hiring Dublin actors to do Belfast accents. Oh. And that was like, you know, the Belfast accent isn't the easiest accent to do. And the Derry accent's even harder to do. Derry accent, that's anyone?
Nye. It's not just Palestinians, it's Arabs as well. They paint Arabs.
Exactly.
Which justifies their treatment of Palestine.
What's happening with you now? Bring us up to date.
I luckily have many irons and many fires. So, I mean, I'm an artist myself, I paint, I have a studio in Belfast. So to be fair, this is actually encouraging me to be more creative in that way. You know, I'm still getting gigs here and there. A few people have stopped booking me, which is fair. And like I said, this whole incident and what's happening.
It's really nice of you to say it's fair. I'm not sure it is.
But. Well, it's not. But, I mean, you know, it's showing them to be, you know.
Yeah. Well, that's another thing about this whole fucking mishegas, as we say in Yiddish, this whole mess, this madness, you know. It's it really shows you who's a fucking decent human being and who isn't.
Yeah.
As well, I think.
I know.
If you can't be on board, this is a genocide, then, you know, I can't have time for you, really.
And it's so many liberal people that I know back home, especially coming from a punk background, you know, amongst those sort of people who were, you know, who'd play their Dead Kennedys records to death, and then you're going, well, now's the, here's your moment.
Yeah.
Here's your moment.
Yes.
To stand up and do the right thing and fight this whole fight, you know. And they're not. There's so many people remaining silent, which is just heartbreaking, to be honest.
I mean, you can say there has been a massive attempt to intimidate, to silence people, but that's the time to speak out.
And then what's happening in the universities as well is
scary because it's like footage that we saw back in the 60s, you know, of the police attacking, especially I saw some footage today of the Dutch police.
Yeah.
With the sticks, the batons, beating the crap out of the peaceful protests over there.
It's kind of a shock.
It really is.
I always thought they were nice. The Dutch police. Yeah. Apparently not.
No.
So you're still gigging or?
Well, Glastonbury's off the table, but I know you guys
cowardly,
are.
Motherfuckers. Oh, like, I mean, I know we're playing it.
I know, but like.
No, I mean,
it's a platform,
you know,
and I know
they banned
that you guys.
The film that I narrated out Jeremy Corbyn.
Oh, yes. I've forgotten about that.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, have they?
Yeah, they banned it again, according to Norman Thomas, the producer.
Of
the film of Jeremy
Corbyn. Oh, right, okay.
I did the narration for it, and they refused, you know, again, they got the same earache from fucking. Campaign against anti-Semitism, and so they withdrew it last year, and I think they're not going to show it this
year.
Well,
yeah, it shocked me. It shocked me that I'm being...
Yeah. I'm still performing there. You cowardly motherfuckers, Glastonbury. You cancel me if you want. I don't care.
Well, yeah, there's going to be an audience with Alexei Sale on Sunday.
Maybe
that'll be an opportunity for you to...
Yeah, address
fucking hold
it.
But that shocked me, because you've been playing there for...
13 years in the theatre in Circusville, entertaining.
And they get one letter.
Parents
and
kid. They get one email. Wow. And they weren't even going to tell me that it was an email. It was really twisted the way
But they know you.
Went
they
about
know
it.
Who you are. They...
I know. And they wouldn't stick up for me. In particular, one person wouldn't, who I know I thought would stick up for me, didn't stick up for me, basically said, there's nothing I can do.
You know who fucking plays Glastonbury every year in the same play area as you? Frank's a Nazi.
Yeah, Frank's a Nazi.
And they're fine with him.
Yeah.
Who's he?
He's like, if Frank Sinatra and Adolf Hitler had a baby, he does crooning, and he sings about, he sings from the point of view of Hitler.
He does it second one.
That's
World
ironic,
War.
I assume.
Yeah, yes. Yes.
Yeah, of course. That's right. That's what all the people say, you know, it's that kind of thing. They walked around with a Hitler moustache, you know.
It's very old school music hall vibes and whatnot.
But Glastonbury, you should be fucking ashamed of yourself.
Yeah, they should. They really should. Especially the fact that the ironic thing is that, I know why I was targeted, not just by the CAA, but also by Glastonbury, is that I'm way down the pecking order. They don't pay much money to have me there, so to kick me off wasn't going to cause them any grief. You know, I don't have a huge platform. I perform in a couple of the platform stages outside in the theater in Circusville. I get people to ride their luck dragons. It's a thing that I do with the whole audience from Neverending Story. But anyway, that's another story. But about 4 years ago, I had one of the... it was recorded that I had one of the biggest outdoor audiences for a comedy show, for a clown show.
Right.
Which was about 3,000 people all just fucking about having fun. And I wasn't going to do anything political because I don't do anything political in my outdoor shows and stuff like that. I was just going to bring a bit of joy to the festival. But 13 years I've been doing it. And the fact that they know me and that they know me and they could have stuck up for me and said, no, this is not Paul. But it was the press office that received the emails and they just went, no, he's gone. But the fact that Lancome are performing, the fact that I know that Dua Lipa is pro-Palestinian, Idols are pro-Palestinian, you know, there's all these other bands. I think Bob Villain's performing as well too, all pro-Palestinian.
And we know they're all going to mention it in their show.
Of course, yeah. It's not going to be broadcast on the BBC, I can tell you that
now.
But they'll talk about it on stage. But
you're going to see a lot of Palestine flags as well on the end of those long poles.
Yeah.
Glastonbury.
Yeah. Because how are they going to ban that from Glastonbury? Yeah. They can't. I know they did it with the Eurovision.
Yeah.
But they're not.
That's not an empty field, is it? Right?
They're never going to ban it from Glastonbury. But
the Israelis have developed a bit of software that automatically edits out Palestinian flags.
Yeah.
Wouldn't be surprised, actually, to be honest. Yeah.
They'd be capable of doing that.
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
Replacing them with the Star of David, with the Israeli flag.
Maybe, they wouldn't go that far. Well, maybe, yeah.
Why not?
Yeah. Well, I don't know. Well, thank you very much, Paul. I don't know. How long have we been going?
1 hour and a quarter. Tell us about your punk band, because just give them a little plug.
Oh, yeah. My punk band's called Rhinos.
Right.
We're a little too... It's just me and another guy, drummer, two-piece punk band. But, we're touring around. trying to get more gigs if anybody's booking any gigs out there. We just played in Liverpool, your hometown, last week for the first time. Actually, that was our very first time playing on mainland UK, was in Liverpool.
Mm.
So yeah, that was great. It was a lot.
I mean, one thing is going to say, where did you play?
Where did we play? In a little club called Outpost.
I
But it's apparently it's two doors down from a famous record shop, which
Probe.
Is no, it's the address of the record shop, which is apparently where John Lennon and Paul used to hang out. It's called is it 31 or 38 something? It's a vinyl record shop.
I don't know.
It's just two doors down. Anyway, slap bang in the middle of Liverpool, but it was great. I had a great time.
I mean, the gigs that you have done, you've done some gigs since the.
Like I said, Glasgow Comedy Festival didn't cancel me.
Right, good
they,
for them.
They specifically said, we are not.
People,
yeah, because they received the CAA emails. And
really?
They, yeah, yeah. And they said, no, we're not cancelling you.
Go fuck yourselves. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Pretty much. Yeah, go fuck off. The only thing that they did receive, the only thing that happened, any incident that happened, was they got a written letter from a cantankerous older man who sent...
Really? Really?
Yeah, just and old I've got school. The letter. I still have the letter.
Old school, yeah.
Old school, yeah.
Yeah.
Stamped addressed envelope.
He
didn't go to the gig, he just sent them a furious letter.
And what was the vibe like at the gig then?
It was fine. It was absolutely fine. The director of the Stand Comedy Club came because I did it in the Stand.
People, yeah.
And the director came to see the show just out of curiosity more than anything. And he came up to me afterwards and was like, is that it? That was it. What was the problem? And I was going, I know exactly.
Yeah.
And I explained to him, this guy heckled me. He was just a hateful heckler. Yeah. And I did what any stand-up comedian does in that situation. I kicked him out. Yeah. The staff weren't kicking him out, so I got rid of him. And I mean, I've kicked many people out of my shows over the years. I don't put up with bullies in my show.
Right.
If they're ruining the whole show for everybody else, then I just get rid of the rotten apples out of the bowl. I just tell them to go because, you know. Especially if it's a solo show. I don't kick them out if it's a mixed bill show. If I'm doing a mixed bill.
That would be
a bit shit, wouldn't it? Yeah, but whatever it's your when it's your show and you've just done 1 hour, then you're like, just fuck off, you know, just go.
I mean when I used to like the really big rooms, what it was if I had a heckler, they were always drunk really. So when they went to the toilet, Linda would go to the foyer with the security and then not let them back in.
Oh, brilliant.
That was what Linda did. That was Linda's role.
Yeah. I mean, I've incited some really hateful people in my shows by just simply performing innocent stuff.
Yeah, I mean, that's not my... I don't... Yeah,
you know, but I mean, Glasgow, one time up in Glasgow, the whole audience split into two and they were... screaming amongst one another.
Right.
I felt like
well, that's the game, isn't it, in your type of comedy?
Yeah.
It's not
for everyone.
Yeah, but it's also not about the guy going on and complaining about it. That is the experience of being an artist in a show, in a member of the audience in a show like yours. Yeah. And it's not about fucking
But it split the audience. I was doing the panda hands bit. I do this bit where I have pandas on my hands and I just sing panda hands to a lot of famous theme tunes like Coronation Street, I can't remember, the A-Team, all sorts of weird random shit. And it's silly. It is just silly. And it is the finale of the show in Glasgow. This was a few years ago. And these burly testosterone blokes... we were clearly at the wrong show anyway.
Yeah.
They just started heckling me and shouting, telling me to fuck off, right? Get off the fuck, you're shit. You're the fucking shit. To which point, the other half of the audience started heckling them to shut up. And then this mini kind of like verbal riot started while I'm kind of carrying on like the fucking Titanic orchestra while all the audience is sinking. But the audience is sinking around me. I'm having a great time on the stilts. on the stage, and I'm just carrying on with my song while all this fucking chaos is happening. Right, it was from an anthropological point of view, it was fascinating.
Wow.
So it's just weird how innocent stuff like that can incite aggression in adults.
But it's also in your case, it's in the case of this particular controversy, it's about trying to cover up genocide, isn't it?
Yeah.
Really? I mean, that's all this shit is about in the end is. Is that really?
If I can just say one more thing, because you mentioned earlier you never had any management or anything.
No,
that gives you the freedom because I follow you on the Instagram and I encourage our listeners to do the same and show Paul some love. But you're very vocal on there and you share content about Palestine and Gaza. Yeah.
Absolutely.
And I've just noticed how many comedians don't do that.
Yeah.
And I have a friend who works at one of the big agencies and she's like, yeah, we tell them not to.
Mm.
They're controlled by their agents and told, if you do that, we're going to probably drop you.
Yeah.
And it's comedians who you... People like Joe Lycett, it really makes me angry, and Sarah Pascoe, because they've always been political comedians. Mm. They've always done things about social justice. You know, especially Lycett had a whole TV show about, was it righting wrongs in society?
Yeah.
Not a single peep about Palestine.
Yeah. Really?
Yeah.
Ever on his socials. And it just confounds me, because that's your whole shtick. It's being righteous and...
Fucking Gary Lineker can do it. You can, but yeah, I mean, you will get earache. I mean, you will. It's not, you know, it takes courage, but then that's, you know, that's why we're comedians.
Well, it just shows you how corporate comedy has become.
That's also how true.
Fucking corporate it's become over the years, you know. Like, I don't know what agencies existed whenever you started with the alternative, with the comic strip and stuff like that. You know,
there wasn't any. There was only old fashioned theatrical agents, really. So that whole being what the Avalons and the open mics and
United Artists,
And Jonathan Thoday and all those they all that came later, really.
Oh, right, okay.
Yeah, there was no agencies then. It was all because we were inventing it all. But it happened soon enough, really. Right, Paul, thank you very much. I think I think this is going for me anyway. It was a fascinating talking to you.
Thank you.
Hopefully, it'll make an amazing podcast and hopefully be an antidote to the lies and propaganda of the pro-genocidists.
Yeah. Yeah.
I hope this helps getting your story out there. Yeah. I'm so sorry for all that shit you've been through.
Thank you. And thanks for letting me explain what happened on the night. Yeah. You know, I mean, at the end of the day, I'm just a clown. Trying to bring a bit of joy.
Yeah.
I'm just a clown looking at another clown. Just want to bring some joy into the world and another clown.
Just trying to tell another clown. Cool.
Thank you. Right.
No, thank you. Okay, that was Paul Curry's story. A story very much of modern Britain. And I was just saying at the Andrew Feinstein launch, I was giving an interview to the Camden New Journal and our local paper, and just saying how this era that we're living through of repression, particularly of pro-Palestinian voices, is it poisons our culture. It poisons our cultural discourse. It poisons the national conversation by limiting speech, by punishing people who supposedly transgress. And even those performers, not just comedians, who don't speak out because they're rightly afraid. They're afraid anyway. It poisons them as well. I think it corrodes at their soul if they stay silent on a genocide, but that's what's happening, really. And so the whole aggressive McCarthyite stance of the Israel lobby really poisons our, sours our national conversation, I think. That's episode 50. It's a good one to have as episode 50. We've evolved, haven't we? We've learned. Over the years,
it's been a journey, as you like to say.
Yeah, it's been a journey.
it is really. Thank you, everyone who listens and has supported us and helped us grow. Because it
feels
it started as these little scripted tidbits that we'd put out, and then became loose. That.
Yeah.
And now, it's this tightly manicured machine of thoughts.
But it's not, you know, we don't have massive, you know, I looking at the figures and that, they're not massive. But, most people at that launch of Andrew Feinstein's
a campaign today, you know, is a listener or a watcher of the podcast.
Oh yeah,
so it's certainly a voice on the left. It's an additional. And speaking of that, I was looking at the comments on YouTube of the podcast that we did with Fred Weston. I thought,
with who?
Fred Weston,
yeah.
And I just thought the comments were some of the comments were so interesting and so, you know, added to the conversation, really. Obviously not the one say, why didn't you go and fight in Gaza? But, you know, that actually, I thought I could respond in the reply, but then I thought, well, I'll respond.
Oh, interesting. That's cool.
Yeah, I'll do it here. You know, not now, but next time.
Oh, okay. I guess it was provocative, not necessarily in that it was it overly angered people or anything, but it was made people, yeah, like some of the most thought out and long comments because I've ever seen.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, because it was, again, I don't know how many people have, you know, listened to it, but I mean, it's, yeah, because of the nature of that particular podcast, that it appealed to people, you know, whereas the Cycling to Gaza one is more emotional and is more of a, you know, it's got a kind of mass appeal. This one, the Fred Weston one appealed, I guess, to people who are more invested in politics and therefore have a kind of position, really. And I just thought some of their replies were really interesting and worthy of further discussion, even some of the, to a degree, some of the negative ones, really.
Yeah.
I'll do that next, but we'll do one just with
we can do it. Yeah, we'll do a mini episode, episode 51. We can do a reflections on that and our first 50 episodes. Why not?
Yeah.
That could be a fun one.
Fuck, we've been all over the fucking place, haven't we?
Yeah. Yeah, it's
been, the bike rides are separate, aren't they?
We could do an episode. I'll get a list of all our episodes, all our guests, and maybe I'll just fire them at you and get your reflections.
I don't remember some of these people.
Exactly, yeah. 50 episodes. Thank you once again, everyone who's listened and subscribes and helps us on the Patreon, patreon.com/AlexiSaleSpodcast. Alexi, I need you to give me 30 seconds because I just got a call from a delivery person at the door. I need to go get this package.
Part of the podcast, yeah.
No, just bear with me 1 minute. Sorry, man.
All right. While he's getting the delivery, I'll sing the canon song from the Threepenny Opera. The troops live under the cannon's thunder from Sim to Cooch Behar. Moving from place to place, when they come face to face with a different breed of fellow, whose skins are black or yellow, they quick as winking chop them into beefsteak tartar. Ba ba da ba 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 da ba da ba da ba da ba 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 da ba da ba da bum 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 bum. I can't remember the verse. Chinese president Jimmy's son. Georgie was shot for looting, but young men's blood goes on being spread, and the army goes on ahead. Recruiting. I'm singing.
I had to run all the way downstairs. Sorry?
I'm singing to the people about. I'm doing the exception of Threepenny Opera for the people. And the army goes on ahead. Recruiting. There you go. The troops live under the cannon's thunder from Sim to Cooch Behar. Moving from place to place, when they come face to face with a different breed of fellow, whose skins are black or yellow, they quick as winking chop them into beefsteak tartar. What was it? You haven't delivered?
Just some fucking stupid shit I bought online.
All right.
I can't even remember what half it is. I'll see. I recognise that song.
Yeah, it's a canon song from the Dreigroschen Opera. It's probably somebody who
fucking
does.
Brecht.
Yeah.
Yeah. I watched that film after our Brecht episode with with Raoul. What's his name?
Which film? We did a Brecht episode?
Yeah, we did a Brecht episode of this show. And Gomez from the Addams Family, something Raoul.
Oh, Oh, God, he died quite young, didn't he? Not Raoul Blades.
He was brilliant.
Yeah, yes, yes, amazing.
As it's the Threepenny Opera. What's the name of the bloody film? Doesn't matter. So you carried on, did you, while I was running up and down?
Yes, I sang them a song while you were running up and down.
Okay.
That's the kind of value you get, people.
Can't wait to listen back to that and decide whether I'm keeping it in. did I promote the Patreon?
You mentioned it.
I did mention it. Patreon.com/Let's Sell Podcast. Give us a look on there. I was listening to David Cross's podcast. He has a new podcast. Do you know David Cross?
Oh, yeah, he plays the. I was watching yesterday. I was watching Kung Fu Panda.
Oh yeah,
and he plays the crane in Kung Fu Panda. And of course, I think, and of course, crane is the style. I do crane style kung fu. So I think he plays the crane.
Well, he's in Arrested Development as well.
Oh, him, right.
And he's great stand-up, really funny, surreal stand-up. And
okay.
He was talking about the Young Ones really fondly.
Oh, really? Oh, well.
He was doing an interview with Bobby Moynihan from Saturday Night Live and brought up the Young Ones on a tangent and seemed very fond of it.
Well, maybe we could get him to come on our...
Maybe we could get him.
Podcast.
Get some Hollywood...
Yeah, get some of that fucking Hollywood glamour...
On the poddy, yeah. Cool. All right, anything else? Any other business?
I did think of something, but I've forgotten what it was.
So we'll do a 50 episodes reflection special. We always suggest to our listeners to donate to medical aid for Palestinians if they have any spare cash. Prioritize that over our Patreon, I say.
We'll do both.
Oh, do you want to quickly talk about the ICC's arrest warrants? Netanyahu,
I don't know.
And the Hamas leader?
I don't know. We'll see, really. I feel nervous about both. All these... I feel nervous about all these institutions like the ICJ and the ICC, whether ultimately they will... let us down, really. I don't quite know what part they play. Certainly people are quite skeptical about, some people are quite skeptical about Karim Khan. KC, I mean, certainly on the face of it, it seems like a marvellous development. And, you know, both the ICJ saying there's a plausible case for genocide and that also that Israel is, you know, Netanyahu and Yoav Gallant are committing war crimes seems indisputable, really. Criminals. And as Jonathan Cook said in his, you know, somebody said there's no comparison between Hamas and Israel. I think Biden said that. No, he's right. Israel is much, much worse. And we'll see, really. I mean, we could maybe get an international lawyer on and Amal Clooney is at Doughty Street Chambers, so she's just down the road. So if she was one of the people who recommended that, along with Helena Kennedy, I suppose we could get Helena Kennedy on in nowhere.
I was going to bring Clooney up because everyone had been having a go at her for being silent about Palestine and everyone was like, you should boycott her. And I did find it curious that she wasn't saying anything, but it turns out she was
working away in the shadows, putting the case together.
Was restricted, couldn't talk about things because it was a case she was working on.
Right. Well done, Amal Clooney. It'd be interesting to have a...
I was curious because they can make these judgments, these laws, you know, and these arrest warrants, but who is it that has to enact them?
They're local. I mean, both Israel and the United States are not signatories to the International Criminal Court. So theoretically, it's up to local police forces to enforce this. So if Benjamin Netanyahu goes on his holidays to Puerto Banus, then theoretically the Guardia Civil could feel his collar.
So in effect, it's just a symbolic gesture unless he takes a holiday.
Britain theoretically, I don't know. I mean, I'm not an I know you think I'm great, everybody, but I'm not. My knowledge of international jurisprudence is, you know, it's serviceable. It's probably not. I wouldn't cast myself as an expert, but you know, theoretically, since Britain is a signatory, if Netanyahu comes to Britain, he could be arrested.
Yeah, you know, I want to see a movie of an Israeli cop who decides to arrest Netanyahu.
Yeah,
and has to go through a gauntlet of you know, all the other loyal police and army, and he's trying to smuggle Netanyahu out of the country.
Yeah, but theoretically, I mean, I think fucking, you know, you see these spokespeople. Sometimes they're clearly British, or, you know, these people, they should be arrested. You know, if they ever return to Britain, they should immediately be arrested for fighting for
IDF soldiers.
Yeah, being fighting for the IDF, they should be immediately arrested, it seems to me.
We're living in a time of double standards, and it's infuriating.
Oh, hell yeah. But we could let's see if Helena Kennedy wants to come on and talk about GLCC.
For now, thank you to Paul Curry for choosing us to share his story.
Yeah.
And solidarity with him. If you out there run any comedy shows or are involved in any comedy festivals,
he's a lovely guy.
Make sure the people running those festivals and shows aren't buying into the bullshit that has befallen him. And we hope... we hope this helps wash away that stain that they fucking...
Yeah, I mean, God, it seems like we could talk forever. I mean, he chose and he was advised not to speak right away. I'm not sure that was the right advice, really, but nevertheless, that's what he chose to do.
But when we reached out, he was like, this will be the safe... He wanted to do it in a safe space.
Yeah. Just thinking about Andrew Feinstein's campaign, and I think you've got, I think if anybody's standing against the power, anywhere, any candidate, you've got to have like a rapid reaction force, definitely. You will know that shit will be pumped out about you, and you've got to respond to that right away, I think. Crush that shit. And I think any politician... Anybody standing on our side in this upcoming elections really needs to take that lesson on board and right away fucking.
Yeah. But, you know, hindsight is a lot easier to. How does the saying go? Hindsight is a lot clearer
down the road than a pork pie.
Then, yeah, that's the one. Yep. That's the hindsight saying that everyone knows. Thank you. Episode 50. We did it. Let's tie a ribbon on it.
Bye bye.
You've been listening to the Alexis L podcast. This show is produced and edited by Talal Karkouti. Music by Tarbush Records. Thanks to Audio Boom for hosting us. Please keep your emails coming in at alexislpodcast@gmail.com. Goodbye.